What is the crack, everyone? What a week it was in Rome. I would say the most enjoyable Ryder Cup since Medina, and I am not at all biased. We had car park brawls, incredible golf, lots of European passion, bit of a US comeback, but most importantly, ultimately a European win. Joining me to discuss is Cooper and Joe, but Cooper, starting with you, you were there for the rest of us looking on with jealousy of what was clearly an incredible buzz. Give us your take of the event as a whole.
Yeah, it was hands down the best sporting event I've ever been at, particularly kind of the Friday, Saturday. Like, I think for golf events, you'd normally kind of expect a bit of a buzz and then the crowd kind of gets behind one person. But when there's 50,000 people chanting for one team and probably about, I think it was 80,000 there on the Sunday. So about, say, whatever, the other half, a smaller majority, still a big number of Americans, but like slightly smaller, are kind of going against each other and getting at each other in chants. It felt like it. And I guess, fitting that it was in Rome, it felt like you're in the Colosseum and two lads absolutely scrapping it out. It was actually a bit overwhelming at some points because you were kind of like, this is fucking bananas. Like, I remember being on the first grandstand. I got up at about 4 o'clock in the morning to get a metro and a bus out to the golf course for about, say, 5:30. Golf didn't start till 7:35. So like, and there was already about 1,000 people standing in line trying to get onto this grandstand. Like, it was just mania. And getting into it then, and kind of, I guess, from about 6 o'clock on, when people started settling into it, or sorry, maybe half six, whatever time they got in, there was an announcer there just getting the crowd absolutely going. Nessun Dorma blaring out over the speakers. Gosh. Like, just... And the sun was rising over Marco Simone at 6:30 in the morning. It was a very special place to be. But no, like, between, as a spectator event, the Ryder Cup is absolutely perfect, because like, I was obviously working at it and I was on the fifth. And I was probably lucky I was on the fifth, because you kind of, just as the players tee off, you're kind of waiting because there's people starting to build up around the fifth already, just as the players are going off. And by the time they get round, you've four matches on the Friday, Saturday. So it's about an hour of golf, really, maybe an hour and 20 minutes. And the players are gone. And then I would just hightail it up to 16 to get a good spot in another bit of an amphitheater of a hole. So like, even if you're not working there, I'd say you might try and get on the first grandstand. You'd run to the eighth, you'd run to the 16th. And then it's just kind of quick, kind of bursts of golf, and twice a day for the first 2 days. And then the singles is just an absolute heap of golf piled on top of each other. And I think there's 15,000 extra fans there on the Sunday as well. So
how easy is it actually to see the golf? I know you were obviously working on the fifth, so I'm sure you had a good view there. And then, but from looking on TV, it seemed like there was lots of natural amphitheaters for people to get a decent vantage point. Was that the case?
Yeah, like from watching the Italian Open there for the last few years, you would not believe how hilly it is. It is like left. So the third fairway is just left of the fifth. And it's 100-foot kind of, not cliff, but just slope. It's like a massive dune in Cairn or something like that, just up to the left of it. To get from the fifth, which is probably the lowest point of the course, up to the 13th, which is probably the highest, particularly the sixth hole, actually, in itself. I think someone was saying there's a 65-foot kind of increase in height fairway to the green. Like, if you're fairway, down the bottom, you only see the flag of the pin. Like, so those kind of, when you watch them on TV, maybe you see a bit of a up the hill shot, but it's incredibly hard to be landing these balls with, especially with the roll-offs pretty much everywhere. To be landing them in the right spot so they hold the green, and getting them close is just even harder. So it gave me a far better appreciation for how difficult that golf course is. It's all well and good saying there's three drivable par fours, all the par fives are reachable, but like some of the par fours on that course were desperately hard, and I guess that added to kind of an incredible match play setup.
Joe, so many things happened over the course of the week. Obviously, the main thing is Europe won. They came out fast. There was the whole drama around Cantley and Lacava. Lowry was losing his marbles. There's so many things that we can discuss. But again, I suppose just more broadly, give us your thoughts and feelings after watching the whole thing.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack from the weekend that was there. There was I suppose the general sense was I was pretty happy with how it unfolded on the Sunday in terms of there being a bit of drama, because there was a feeling, especially as, like, if you remember on Saturday evening, McIlroy and Fitzpatrick were in that last match against Cantley. So before he went and birdied the last three holes to turn the match around, we were looking at 11.5 to 3.5, was it, going into the Sunday, and that would have just been, you know, it would have been over after, you know, the first three matches. So I think, first of all, Cantley turning that match around added a bit of spice. I would have liked McIlroy to go 5-0 for the week. I think that contributed to his anger and frustration at the end, and, you know, what boiled over with him, which was at the same time great to see, I think, for everyone from the outside looking in, added a bit of spice to proceedings. But yeah, I think we talked about last week about putting the foursomes first, because Europe's record in foursomes is so much stronger, and, you know, that obviously became apparent very early on the Friday morning, when we took that 4-0 lead early on, and kind of, you know, I think we were 3-1 in the foursomes on Saturday morning as well. We completely dominated them. It's amazing how these things stick with the way they normally are. Like, same with the course setup being a home Ryder Cup. That's over 30 years now that US, the next chance they'll have will be 34 years at Adair Manor, obviously in 2027. So hopefully whoever's captain then will have a good say in how the course is set up. But I thought it was entertaining. I would have liked it a bit closer. Like, I think for a short period on Sunday, it obviously seemed like there was going to be this charge from the US, and that was exciting, and I was happy Europe came out on top. But 16.5, 11.5 is a big enough margin. But I thought our stars came through, like these guys, like Ram, Hovland, and obviously Rory. There's a reason why they're the best in the world. They got 10.5 points between the three of them out of our 16.5. So, you know, an unbelievable return. Hovland is just on this unbelievable ascent. He's great to watch. He's so exciting. He smashes at everything. And obviously he's improved his short game so much as his chipping. Like, that chipping on the first on the Friday was insane. Like, probably, I don't know if it's a shot he would have tried last year. Would he have just tried to put that? But yeah, like those boys, and then Ram, you know, when he's got the bit between his teeth, just, he looks like a hard man to stop. That was a great half from him against Scheffler on the Sunday. And then, yeah, Rory obviously, you know, got the 4 out of 5 wins. So I think that was huge. You know, back in 2021, Whistler Straits, Rory was ranked, I think he was 16th in the world, 15th in the world at that point. We'd only one top 10 player. you know, we'd three of the top four this time, we'd six in the top 12 or 13. And, you know, that obviously that contributed to the overall result, I think. And was it McIlroy in his press conference said, you know, basically, I'm paraphrasing, but you know, we're gonna win this in Betpage in 2025. So, you know, very confident. Yeah, that was good to see.
Just Jesus, loads to comment on what you said there, Joe. But first of all, it might have been nice for you sitting at home watching a bit of a sweater to be close, but it was not a pleasant experience on the course. The one issue was, like, for a lot of Sunday when I finished, we went down to the 16th, and like I was sure the winning putt was going to come on 16. So stay there, and there's a big TV across the lake, and you'd hear an absolutely massive roar from the other side of the course, and then there's a fucking delay with the coverage, and you're like, oh, for fuck's sake, we missed something here. So at least when you heard a big roar, you knew it was good. When you heard this little dim kind of USA, then you knew it was going to be bad news. But we were chatting to a few Americans there at the time, and they were getting proper giddy. They were like, oh, we have them on the ropes, and just couldn't say anything, because at the time there was seven matches to go, and we were up in the last two. And we were only one or two up, and they were on the 11th. So, like, plenty of time for those two matches to turn around. Like, it was fucking squeaky bum time for every European.
What was the sense on the golf course? What was the feeling in general amongst the fans?
Oh, the US are going to 3-wood onto the green, and Europeans started hugging. Like, it was total relief. Like, genuinely, there was everyone on the course supporting Europe was sweating balls, and it wasn't just the 35 degrees heat. Like, the Americans then kind of got deflated then, and a few got a bit salty, fucking classic. But there was genuine fear on the course for at least an hour.
As I would, Joe, you pointed to the matches being close, and that was the overall score not necessarily being close, but at the time there was a squeaky bum time there in the middle. And for me, that hour or so was probably the best hour of the whole thing.
Definitely.
It was when there was the most jeopardy. Like, Max Homa standing over that 7-footer, Cooper, I assume you didn't see it live, but that moment was almost the highlight of the week. That and Rory nearly sparking the head off Bones in the car park.
Yeah, he had an incredible interview there with was it four player no laying up one of them, and he's like, you always dream of holding the winning putt for a Ryder Cup, you don't necessarily dream of holding a putt not to lose the Ryder Cup. And he did say afterwards that he said he was visibly shaken. He said there was 50 phones in my pockets and they were all ringing, and you look at it and you're like, no, he's grand. But one of the first things he said to his caddy afterwards was, did you see me shaking? Like, he was genuinely in terror of it. And he goes back to, to a Ryder Cup match? Or sorry, a Walker Cup match.
I think it was college match.
College golf. Yeah. And like that he missed a similar putt for the win, and he just wants to be in that position again. And he has been in that position since, but he'd never been in this one where it was not to lose and to keep everything moving. He's just the most, like, Victor Hovland's the most likable guy in golf. Max Homa is fucking second behind him. Like, yeah. So I was delighted he did that.
Normal bloke, yeah. And the it's interesting that he said how rattled he was. And obviously you'd be so rattled. Like, if it was me, I'd barely be able to like take the quarterback. But the calm head with the drop before that. So just to
Well, he said his caddy made him do it.
Oh, really? So the caddy deserves a lot of credit there.
An absolute heap of credit. He said he's not going to make that putt. Take a drop. Trust yourself. Get up and down. So, unbelievable.
That's brilliant. Because I was kind of thinking there, if the lie was really bad, which it seemed to be, obviously he took an unplayable, taking a drop back He had to obviously play a shot over the bunker. I would have thought if he, even if the lie is really bad, he could hack it out into the bunker in front of him, and then it's not too bad and up and down. But
No. He, like, Fitz was in for par, so he needed to, after the unplayable, had to get up and down.
Yeah,
but if it
yeah.
It comes out hard at that lie. If it carries the bunker, he's in the water the other side.
Well, that's
yeah.
The thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So
oh, it was
such a good
easy.
Decision.
Yeah. Yeah, great decision.
And it was executed perfectly, the chip and the putt, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I did think he was close, but
I was actually fist pumping at home at making that putt almost. Because the whole thing, like, things were looking in favor of Europe. And I kind of felt that Europe were going to win this regardless. But at least this gives us another bit of drama. And clearly, Cooper, that rippled through the course. And there probably was that belief amongst the Americans that, like, hold on a minute, we actually could do this.
Genuinely, if Rahm didn't get the half out of Scheffler and Homa went and did that afterwards, like, that everyone kept saying that Rahm half a point was so fucking crucial, and it was in the end. Like, well, maybe it wasn't, but you kind of look at Larry, would Larry have won 18 if he fucking needed to, potentially? Like, he was a bit euphoric going down the 18th, and that was absolute madness. Actually, I was on the fairway for that, kind of circling the green.
Thing, wasn't it?
it was like a US Open in Brookline, when you can picture the black and white pictures of the crowd circling the green. But I think Larry would have won that anyway. Just if we needed another half a point, or just gotten, yeah, if, whatever the kind of permutations will be. But the Rahm point was enormous. The Max Homa up and down was enormous in the other ways. So, like, as you said, though, Con, it gave us, it Fitz Homa holding that literally gave us another era of golf, like, to an extent.
Yeah. That was my
so I think we were all happy enough, but, like, yeah, it was definitely sweaty. And, like, the 16.5, 11.5 does not reflect it at all. Like, it was, I think it was a lot closer than that, or it felt a lot closer than that on the course. Maybe that's just me on the course, though.
It was the whole thing of what Dave, in fairness, actually accurately predicted last week. He said, we all predicted that Europe were going to win, but Dave called out that Europe are probably going to get off to a fast start and then kind of hold on. And that is what happened. So the win was done in that first session, really. And then
Captain, just kind of, Captain Masterclass.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we'll get on that in a sec. But firstly, Joe, Patrick Cantlay, do you like him more or less after that week?
More.
No.
Me too.
No, 100%. Yeah. Like, he now adds a bit, whereas before, you know, on a Sunday, even watching the PGA Tour event, I'd be pushed closer to turning it off than anyone else, you know, inside the top 10, I would say. No, I think... I as a person, I don't know, like, I definitely, I'm not as big as fan, but now, as, like, you know, as someone who is considered entertaining golf, I would say he's gone up the, you know, echelons in that sense. Obviously, this, you know, this tweet, and I don't know if you have it in front of you, Con, for anyone who hasn't seen it, but, you know, I suppose it was Jamie Weir of Sky Sports who alluded to the fact that Cantlay wasn't wearing a hat because he wasn't, the US team weren't getting paid for their appearance in the Ryder Cup. And I suppose this was sort of, I suppose Jamie Weir was led to believe this because in the President's Cup, they do get paid. I think that every player on the team in the 2022 President's Cup anyway got $250,000. So, you know, and also I think that the character that Cantlay portrays himself as, it made it a bit more believable as well. And then there was this sort of assertion that him and Schauffele were sitting in a different position in the locker room. And anyway, all of this was happening while they were playing their match, I think, on Saturday afternoon. But someone, I can't remember who said it, said that Cantlay actually hadn't seen the tweet and when everyone started waving the hats, you know, ironically, sarcastically, after Cantley Hold up put for the win on 18 on Saturday afternoon, I think someone said that he didn't know why people were doing it, but he just went along with it. You know, he was doing the air shake of the hat.
Put in there, Joe, like, there is no fucking way he didn't hear hats off for the bank account. Because
yeah, was it being shouted by everyone? Because you wonder how much these guys actually, like, read social media. I suppose someone has probably got to be in their ear. But I don't know if it's the best thing for Joe Lacaba to be like, by the way, everyone thinks this, you know, when he's teeing off.
Yeah. He may not have, he may have kind of thinking, like, what's going on here? But he might not.
That might have been earlier before the 18th. But yeah, it was, it added to the event so much. I thought Lacava was wrong as well. I thought definitely wrong. I mean, celebrating in the first place, no problem with that. You know, like, bit of jumping around, looked like he essentially kept them in the competition, and you know, the caddies have a massive part to play in any golf event, let alone the Ryder Cup. So I think that's right. But when McIlroy, he overstepped the line a bit initially, but then when McIlroy told him to back off and he was basically frustrated at that, then he was completely in the wrong, obviously. He needs to step off to the side. But yeah, I thought that was wrong. And then what happened in the car park with McIlroy, like, McIlroy was obviously fired up. It's crazy to believe that actually was all genuine. I think it probably was, but it was so crazy and so, like, unlike anything we've seen before, I think, from Rory anyway. Like, Larry holding him back like he was outside a nightclub at 2 a.m. Like, it was it was insane. Yeah, oh no, it's unbelievable. So it's like, you know, it lived up to the billing in that sense. So yeah, like, the you know, a long-winded way to go about it. I think in terms of Cantley, I think he made a comment after in the media being like, no, the hat just doesn't fit me, you know, and that was, he kind of said it, you know, in a humorous way. He knew that people would take that the way they would, and I thought it was good. And in fairness, he stepped up. Like, that was like those few shots coming in, like that that shot to 17, such a good shot. But then to hold the putt after as well, when he knows most people don't like him as well, you know, that makes it more impressive.
The defiance against the crowd, the abuse, the toy that was completely against the Americans at that time, like, he was clearly the scapegoat or the brunt of all the abuse from the European fans and everything. All the narrative up until that point was that this was such a disaster. It's a split dressing room. Himself and Schauffele, as you mentioned, Joe, are off doing their own thing and they're against this whole Ryder Cup thing. For him to just stand up and let his golf do the talking, like, in the twilight, like, it was getting dark, the whole scene there, he holds that putt, like, that was just balls. I thought it was so good.
Yeah, I was watching it with one of the lads, and, like, just, I think it was maybe just because you'd seen Rahm and Hovland hold monsters on 18 before, you were like, oh, fuck, he's going to hold this, isn't he? Even though we were in such a great position with Fitz and McIlroy inside him, but, like, I genuinely, when Lacava started kind of throwing the hat and pointing the finger at Rory, it went from kind of like when you say he's the villain, yeah, he is, like, but at the same time, he's playing incredible golf and you appreciate it. Like, the kind of boos or whatever when he's walking down the fairway, like, it's not malicious, but there was genuinely, I thought someone was going to rush onto the green. Like, it was proper berating Joe Lacava specifically. Like, the crowd were all, it went from kind of friendly boos to, you fucking scumbag, like, proper,
yeah,
proper roar. And this is before McIlroy and Fitz had put, like, and like, guys coming out like Freddie Couples saying, tell me what he did wrong. It's like, are you blind? Like, watch the... There's one video, I think, maybe Sky did it. McGinley was commenting on it, and they showed the full interaction from as soon as Cantlay took the putt to when Lecava finally calms down. It's like, it's over a minute long. Like, he's literally waving the hat around for 30 seconds. And it's just, yeah.
He must have had pent-up emotion.
Yeah, pent-up emotion, but, like, fuck off. Like, they're not waving their hat at you. Like, and I just kind of thought about it from, if that was a player and a player did that, if Cantlay was doing that and was getting in Rory's way, there would be war. So, like, Lecava shouldn't have any... I think I was hoping that that was going to be a catalyst for an absolute inferno on Sunday from the Europeans. Obviously it wasn't. Rory did say it fired him up a bit, but yeah, it's definitely one of the stranger moments in Ryder Cup history. And from loving him on the bag for Tiger to now hating him on the bag with Paddy Ice, not a massive fan of Joe Lecava anymore. But yeah, just on the Cantlay stuff as well, like, there's so many reports going around as well. Like, I will also say that the Ryder Cup players don't get paid directly, but they do get to make a 200 grand donation to a charity of their choice. They do get it added to their PGA Tour pension or DP World Tour pensions.
Well, split between all other players.
Yeah, but like, it's not like they get nothing. So,
I think they shouldn't get anything for playing.
Let me put it to you like this. So the Ryder Cup is a commercial behemoth. The number that I saw floated around was 500 million in revenue it generates. There's lots of different parties that are making money from the Ryder Cup. And the biggest contributors to the success of the Ryder Cup is the players. Is there any argument that they should get paid?
Like, I don't. I think if you're putting out a player who is in any way interested in what they're getting paid for, essentially maybe two trips to a fucking different country and 7 days work, and they don't want to play in that. Sorry, not even they don't want to play in that. If they don't want to be part of the Ryder Cup without money being involved, they shouldn't be there. Like, it's... And I think if you asked every European player, there might be maybe one or two would say, yeah, maybe it's might be interesting. They're making a lot of money commercially. I'd say if you asked the Americans, I'd say over half them would probably be kind of more inclined to kind of push it from a money side for their own benefits. So, like, Europeans, just someone said actually during the week, when you think of the European Ryder Cup legends, like Seve, Woosnam, Langer, like even McGinley, like anyone who's kind of made a lasting impression on someone from something they did in the Ryder Cup. And when you think of the American side, like I think of Freddie Couples more from President's Cup, kind of incredible moments than I do from Ryder Cup. It just seems to be more ingrained here that it's an incredibly special tournament. And in the States, I don't think you can cultivate that for a long time, but it just seems to be more of a European competition and we just care more about it. And maybe that's why we're kind of saying, like, absolutely, why would they get paid? Like, they should be privileged to be part of the Ryder Cup. But maybe it's just a different view in the States, and like, it's just money rearing its ugly head in golf again and potentially poisoning something that, like, should never have gotten touched by an argument around money.
Yeah, well, there's two sides to it, because like, the Ryder Cup is everything for the DP World Tour. Like, they need that money so badly. It's, you know, the biggest generator of revenue. Whereas the flip side of that is the PGA Tour doesn't get, well, it gets some, but it doesn't get the other side of the revenue. It's the PGA of America. And they, you know, divvy that out between certain bodies, and they give 20% to the PGA Tour, which, as Cooper said, they put into the pensions. And apparently some of it goes to FedEx bonus pools as well, which most of these guys get to take advantage of, obviously. But I suppose the problem is though as well that like they push this narrative of the Ryder Cup being about like, you know, well, it's above money, it's about, you know, the morality, and but then you've got this hypocrisy with all the advertisement that they do. So I mean, they probably need to cut down the advertising, and you know, they're still going to generate enough revenue from, you know, other streams and, you know, just attendances, and there's loads of different streams obviously, but there's definitely a bit of hypocrisy there from the people that are like, no, well, you should be doing it, you know, for the pride of your country and, you know, the history and stuff. But then these same people will sign up to these huge advertising deals. So there is definitely a bit of hypocrisy there, I think. But I don't think players, their brand, like, look at Ian Poulter. Like, you know, his brand from the Ryder Cup is, you know, catapulted himself. He probably would have got a live contract potentially. There's no way he would have got what he did get from them. You know, you can multiply it by, you know, four. And the same goes for a few other players as well. So I think that, you know, there's so many benefits, and maybe some of them don't look at the long term sort of benefit. Did you see Xander Schauffele's dad came out and was speaking about it, and he was like, you know, okay, fair enough, you're not playing the players, but then with the pot of money that you do get, you know, we don't want 200 grand to go to the players to donate to charity. We want all of it to go to charity. What so do that as an alternative. Which is an interesting proposition, because it's a tough one to argue after you've, you know, paid all the relevant expenses and whatnot. But
where he said, "What do you think about Jay Monahan? If he had a spine, he would have resigned." and you can quote that.
Yeah,
he seems like a mad bastard.
Yeah, that's not a great look for Schauffele himself to have his dad, because, you know, you would think then that's a representation of what Schauffele is actually thinking himself. But I think with the financial aspect, I think there's no doubt about it, it's pretty complicated. I think first and foremost, the players would, for the most part, wouldn't care about the money. It's absolutely not about the money. It's like playing for your country in football or whatever. Your biggest dream as a footballer when you're growing up as a kid is to go play in a World Cup and all that sort of stuff, and I think the Ryder Cup is the equivalent of that. I think from a financial perspective, the DP World Tour would probably be on its knees if they couldn't take advantage of the revenue that they get from the Ryder Cup. I'm pretty sure that they get a good portion of whatever revenue is generated when it's at home. So that, say that 500 million after you divvy it all out, I don't know how much is left over, but the European Tour get a good percentage of that they don't get again for another 4 years. So that has to sustain them for a period of time. Is there an argument that 24 players should get $1 million each, for argument's sake, 24 million out of that pot? I mean, maybe.
But what's £1 million to these lads? They're the 24 best golfers on the planet. Like if it was like some lads who were lower down in the world rankings and they were £1 million meant a lot to them, like for fucking half these lads are making £24 million in a year. Well, not half them, say like the top three definitely are: Scotty, Ram, Hov, McIlroy. Like the money, like it literally shouldn't be part of the conversation. But I totally agree why it might be brought up, because it's such a behemoth. But like when you're kind of talking about money in the Ryder Cup, like the money is coming in from the TV viewership, from sponsors, from obviously tickets and VIP bits, whatever. But apparently the coverage was deplorable in the US.
I heard that.
Ads, like some people say, I'd say I saw more of the golf than some of the people in the US based on what they were saying about the advertisements. They said it was an absolute joke. I think they didn't see Spieth for 8 holes, something like that, in the singles. Like it was completely like all over the place. And then when they did see him, he was actually on the wrong hole and the score was already up from the fucking previous hole. Like it was just run horrifically bad.
That's TV in America in general though, isn't it? It's shocking.
Yeah. No, but that if if this is meant to be kind of a pure event and the players don't get money, then why are they shoving advertisements down the viewers' throats? Like, it, there has to be a balance there. If they're overdoing the advertisements, the players are going to want more of that pool of money that's going to grow as they make more advertisements. And I'm surprised Rolex don't jump in here and say, we'll do a Rolex hour for the entire thing, or that kind of, that's my favorite part, the British Open, the Rolex hour, where there's just no ads and it's pure golf. And it's, maybe you can't do that when there's only four matches on the course, but you can definitely do that on a Sunday. And like from the viewership side, or not the view, yeah, there was a massive drop in the NBC viewership, but apparently a big cause of that was Azinger. Apparently he was awful. Like he said the same thing about 20 times. He didn't really have any value to what he said. He was just kind of watching a movie he'd never seen before and describing what was happening in the movie. Like, it just, I think he might be getting the boot at the end of the year. Just like, and that's from Americans now. So I'm not sure what they see on a week to week basis with him, and if he was just particularly bad this week for some reason. But Sky's numbers were all right, but they'd all decreased from France. So like this and a massive decrease in the US, but this absolute kind of overload of ads is having a very negative effect.
That is interesting. Like, I would have thought the global interest in golf has picked up since the pandemic. That's what all the stats are saying. More people are playing golf.
Oh, it is. And that's what they were. I'd say that's what they were selling it on as well. Like, they're saying 2.4 million people watched on Sunday last year. This year, only 1.6 million watched. You told us 4 million people ago. Oh, I'd say, yeah. It's going to be a lot conversation.
Yeah, surprised by that. Just to round off the financial part of the conversation, for the record, I actually don't think that the players should get paid. But I do think that there is just an element of human nature where no one likes to feel like they're being taken advantage of. And I think if you're that player and you're looking at it saying, well, hold on, all of you guys are making all this money and we're not. But I do ultimately feel that they shouldn't get paid, and they're just doing it for the pure passion. And speaking of pure passion, Mr. Ryder Cup is no longer Ian Poulter. It's Mr. Shane Lowry. Can I ask, is there an element of Shane Lowry spoofing a little bit there to try become that guy, the Ian Poulter? So next time around,
is he trying to win the Jacqueline Nicklaus Award? I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm so worried. Dave is not here to discuss Justin Rose winning the Jacqueline.
He's the real winner this week.
He is.
Ryder Cup.
Yeah. But on the Shane point, like, part of me was looking at him saying, hold on, are you just like trying to schmeagle your way in here for a future pick now as a passionate man? But no, that isn't fair. Like, it obviously seemed to be genuine, but it was, Jesus, he was going bananas, wasn't he?
I think he thinks he's playing a county final, like every day, every time he's out there. Like when Hovland held that putt on the Friday evening on the 18th green, and Lowry was just dancing, like he almost tripped up running down the 18th fairway celebrating.
Oh, so funny.
Look, he loves it.
He does.
Yeah, there might be an element to that though. There could be. But I do think he gets so fired up for it though.
Yeah.
And only having lost one. That's his only experience as well.
Yeah, true. I'll throw it back at you, Con, then. That's your slanderous remark. So with Larry, say, like he's a fiery enough lad when he's on his own, and when he was in Whistling Straits, like it's 90% Americans, like no support at all. Suddenly he gets tossed into this fucking Coliseum, and there's 60,000 people roaring his name in adoration, and he can finally support with, like, golf is so individual, and like you might see a few Irish flags walking down in the British Open and you get a cheer from them, and the rest of the crowd might clap, but they're not cheering for you. Like, imagine 60,000 people roaring at you saying, come on. Like, I can only imagine the adrenaline, the feeling of, like, one of the last lads, literally say, yeah, Hovland as an example, or I think Fleetwood, that one of the images from Friday was him literally like a gazelle bounding down the fairway, fist pumping everywhere. But like with so many people staring at you, like surrounding you and celebrating like lunatics, and you're just there fucking amping them up in the middle. I think it would actually kind of possess anyone to go a bit mental. So I don't think it's put on, but I think it's just in these circumstances in Ryder Cups, home Ryder Cups, where the momentum is with you and everyone is just on a fucking high. I think, yeah, I think anyone who really cared about it, which he clearly does, would go a bit mental.
Yeah, I know. Look, I am messing. I can't lie that the thought did cross my mind at times, but I do agree. I think he was like, Shane Lowry seems to be the type of guy who would almost have preferred to be like a county footballer for Offaly or something than a golfer, just in terms of the whole team and the whole crack aspect. Like, so many golfers are robotic and, you know, they go through the college system in the States or whatever. Lowry wasn't that. He's clearly like a almost like just a normal lad who loves going for a pint and loves his GA and stuff. So yeah, being involved in a team event like that, where, as you say, Cooper, everyone is in his face shouting his name, the chanting, like the outpouring of emotion from him was insane. Like, it must be the most electric feeling to be in that situation where you're in this cauldron of pressure. And he did so well. Like when he held that putt on the 17th against Spieth, the relief, and you could just feel the whole thing pouring out of him, and it was very cool.
But just being guaranteed a half there, I'd say it was just pressure gone. I don't think he wanted to win the match, but like, Tommy had been in already, he knew the crack, just kept me down, my team here, let me enjoy it. But no, it was like, I can't remember when it was. I think it was Saturday. No, Friday morning. Yeah, it was with Straka on Saturday. And like, he was coming down the fairway, and I think whoever was ahead of him had finished and they came back to him. And like, just as you said, gone, like, the kind of high fives and the chats and the walking down and the getting the crowd going. Like, he's a team player true and true. And the Ryder Cup just brings the best out of him. And that's kind of what Donald wants. Like, I'd say he kind of talks about doing it for more than just yourself. That was the whole kind of ethos of the European team this week. Like, whether it's for your family or for your teammates or whatever, it's a kind of, and Larry said it afterwards as well. He's like, if I didn't score any points and we won, I wouldn't give a shit. Like, it's that kind of true team mentality. And he's just, yeah, he's a perfect guy to have in there. And obviously he's a pretty decent golfer, so he takes home a few points.
Joe, two kind of questions. Cooper mentioned there Donald and the atmosphere and culture that he did clearly instill in the Europeans last week. Well, Dave kind of mentioned that the captains are slightly over hyped, maybe. First question is, do we think the same now? Not, I know that was Dave's point, not necessarily yours, but like, firstly, how important is the captain and the role that they play, comparing Donald to Zach Johnson, who clearly didn't perform as well? And then the second question is kind of related. Is the US, is it just a case that it's very hard to win a Ryder Cup away, or is there something deeper that the Americans can't do that the European side can?
Yeah, well, with the first question, like, I think the captain's role, it is important. I do think it's overplayed a bit, though. Like, there's so much that goes into it, and I think, you know, Donald seemed like a good captain. Like, there was an element of, like, I think what weren't sure whether he would be like an inspiring captain, but you know, I think we also made the point that someone who kind of like gets out of the way is often that works out to be you know, a better captain than the alternative. But I think like plenty of good decisions, like putting the foursomes first on the Friday, that was a great decision. Obviously, you know, the data told them that, you know, we're typically strong in that, and, you know, get the points on the board early, and that's what they did. I think, you know, picking Aberg, that was probably an obvious decision given he won the weekend before the picks. But I think, you know, putting him out with Hovland, finding good pairing for him, he did that well. Speaking of pairings, I think Lowry said in his interview as well after on Sunday that he knew he was playing foursomes with Straka a few weeks before the Ryder Cup. So, you know, we made a point about the ball last week as well. Obviously, they're both Strixen. So, you know, that was probably one reason. But, you know, Lowry had time to, you know, they'd probably time to get to know each other, because, you know, they probably don't know each other that well. Straka's still, you know, only a couple of years on tour. He's actually a couple of years younger than Lowry. So, you know, developing those bonds in advance. And also another thing he did well was for the scouting trip that they did a few weeks ago with the team, the Europeans brought the caddies along, and they had the full complement of 12 players. The US team didn't bring any caddies along, and they obviously only had 9 players there. We know well that Cantlin and Schauffele were missing, and Brooks, I think, was playing a live event. But they didn't even bring the caddies along. So it just sounded like maybe there was a bit, you know, it was taken a bit less serious, whereas the Europeans were there for business. But, you know, at the end of the day, when the first ball's hit on Friday, the players need to go out and do it as well. So I think Donald deserves a lot of praise. I'm not sure he deserves as much praise as he's getting, and captains generally do.
But the converse of that, so take your point that, okay, Donald maybe got out of the way. He made good decisions, but he was shrewd in the background, all that sort of stuff. But there was clearly a gap there with Zach Johnson.
Yeah, I suppose that you have to look at them. What did Zach Johnson do badly? I think not making the caddies come to the practice was a big one. The probably most glaring fact, and I know McGinley labored this on Sky Sports as well, but like, the Americans were rusty. Like, I think 9 of the 12 didn't play for 5 weeks, didn't play competitive golf for 5 weeks. I think Homa played the fourth net, and he was clearly their best player on the team, and that was only a couple of weeks before the Ryder Cup. So, you know, he wasn't in the same camp as the others, and I think JT played it as well. He had his own reasons, obviously trying to get himself fit, and Brooks played a live event. But for, you know, 7 of the 8 guys going out in the morning foursomes on the Friday hadn't played competitive golf in 5 weeks. I think definitely questions to be answered there. You know, there was a couple of big European Tour events going on. Why didn't they play Wentworth? You know, there was a good field there. And yeah, there's no way I can support Zach Johnson that. At the same time, like, do you need to realize that these guys should know their own game at this point? Like, they're all major championship golfers. You know, they're all, you know, they've all played a few Ryder Cups. They should know what they need to get their game in form. It's funny though, I don't think any of those guys, the US guys, would have gone 5 weeks before a major without playing competitive golf. And that does sort of show. Yeah, I just think that shows the sort of, I think there's a bit of a disparity there between how much they care and how much the Europeans care. I think there is definitely an element to that. And yeah, maybe, you know, maybe that lends itself to the conversation we've just had about the financial reward, in that they know that, you know, there's no financial incentive to be playing before. But yeah, I think those couple of points there, I would say I'd have to criticize Johnson for, but also definitely the players. But at the same time, like, can Johnson control number one player in the world losing 9 and 7 to a guy who's never played a major in his life? You know, there's no way for him to predict that. There was a lot of people saying that Scheffler should have been paired with Brooks, and he did that.
Just on that, Joe, sorry. Brooks only found out he was playing with Scheffler half an hour before that tea time.
Well, if that's true, then that's obviously pretty poor. Now, I wonder is that because they were meant to play four ball together, but I wonder, was it because of Burns being quite poor in the initial match that they had to pull him for the foursome? So yeah, he should have probably looked at all eventualities, given Burns was also the 12th man really on the team. He was the last man to be picked. I think JT was always going there, so I think Burns was the last man to be picked. So yeah, like I do think there's definitely elements of that. But then like no one's really criticizing Johnson from within, but I think there, you know, that's been done before, and we've seen how that's played out, you know, with Mickelson criticizing Watson, like that never goes down well. But yeah, I think there's definitely elements there that he could have done better. But I do think it is overplayed a small bit, the captain's role. I think the players. I think there's definitely bad captains and good captains. Like I think Faldo was a pretty poor captain in 2008. We chatted last week about like Hal Sutton putting Phil with Tiger in 2004. But there's also an element of the result dictates how you view someone as well.
Yeah, like as in when you talk about good and bad captains, the good captains usually it's far easier to spot a bad captain than a good captain. And like Donald is obviously getting massive praise, and to be fair to him, like you mentioned him all there, Joe, like the pairings in the previous events, getting players to play together, not necessarily so they'll play together, they've played together before, but just to get to know each other and know that, listen lads, I'm thinking of putting you two in foursomes together, like go have dinner together after the round as well, that kind of thing. The course setup, the format, the foursomes thing was a stroke of genius, like bringing Eduardo in on the stats side, who already works with Fitzpatrick and Hovland, like again, really good move. Like everything he did was, it'd be very hard to see him not taking that job again for Betpage. Whereas poor Zach, like in hindsight, yeah, we can criticize all we want, but like, It's just easier to criticize a bad captain than it is to, I guess, notice how well of a job a good captain has done. I do agree it's been overplayed a little bit, as in just the king Donald. But like at the same time, it's he did everything he needed to do. It worked out, and I don't see any reason why he shouldn't be the captain for 2025.
I think that would be an interesting one. Bethpage 2025. It's not a thing anymore that they do repeat captains. I wonder, like, when I think it was during the press conference or during the trophy presentation, they were shouting, the players were all shouting, two more years, as in for Donald to take the lead. And then Donald deflected, but then he just said, oh, well, I haven't been asked. So there was kind of a hint.
He's available. Yeah.
I am available. So that would be
who's the favorite for the US?
Tiger.
Fucking Tiger. Talk about the most individual man in the world leading the Yanks to another massive downfall.
But I do think that the players idolize Tiger so much that like what he would say is gospel, and he was a very successful captain in Melbourne.
That was Melbourne, yeah.
And playing captain, of course, the ego had to go ahead and get some points on the board as well himself.
I'd love to see it, but I don't know if he's the right person. Not if he's the right person, but like the Americans need more than this kind of godlike figure to prop them up. They need someone to actually bring together, like exactly what Donald has done. I don't know who that is in the US. I would have thought about.
I wonder what Stricker might come back. I'd say there's a chance of some, or Davis Love. He won 2016 with them, I think. And then Medina, he lost, but like he did everything right in the foursomes and four balls in Medina. The singles just went so wrong for them, and there's definitely a level you can't control in that. So yeah, I'd say Stricker, Davis Love, if Tiger doesn't go for it, but it's inevitable he will. But the more interesting one is definitely the European team, because we had like a queue of captains, you know, and all of a sudden Liv happens and you've lost Poulter, Westwood, Garcia, Keimer, GMAC, obviously he would like to see himself in that position, and obviously Stenson, who should have been captain this time. So like all of a sudden, like who else, who's the alternative? That's kind of the big question here.
I've seen the betting odds for the US captains.
No.
Like Tiger is favorite, and then Stuart Sink is second favorite. Matt Kuchar is third favorite. Like imagine that captain and Ryder Cup team. Like literally, good luck. Like they're
He'd be getting paid anyway for
Mickelson's next, believe it or not. Mickelson is the fourth favorite to captain the US World Cup in 2025.
What I was gonna say though, surely experience counts for something in a job, and that's what it is. It is a job. So like it is an interesting one where the choice around captaincy seems to be like presented as an honor, like an award for your service over the years. Whereas perhaps it's better to give the captain, treat it more like a job, who's the best person for this job. And therefore it's not like a ceremonial thing. So like Luke Donald, I think there's a very good argument there that like he's been a successful captain in Rome. In a way, is the pressure off because he goes to Bethpage knowing that the odds are stacked against him and that he is a good like captain, he's got the home record anyway, and take what he's learned from that and take it to Bethpage.
I would absolutely love it.
I do think like right now I'd be very happy, and if they were just like you know it today as well, so that like you know there's a plan made straight away. But there's always continuity with these things as well, so like I'd be very surprised if there was a captain that wasn't a vice captain or Donald this year. You know, they normally do like to put someone in there, get a bit of experience, and then quite often I suppose someone who's a former captain like Jim Furyk and Stricker this year in the US is a vice captain, you know, to guide them along a bit. But yeah, I think I'd like to see it. Yeah, break the mold. You know, I think was it Bernard Gallagher was captain 3 years in a row back in the kind of 80s sort of time, and he had a very successful run with it as well. So if the alternative is to bring Poulter back in, then Donald is the man all day.
Con doesn't agree.
Yeah, bring on Poulter now. Right, we should wrap it up. I mean, there's so much more that I would even love to have talked about.
Good few lads, actually. Aberg is over in the States. Fitz, Mac. Good few lads playing this week.
Yeah,
Dunhill is a great event, to be fair.
Dunhill is a great event. Yeah, I'll very much look forward to it. And the players all seem to really enjoy it, especially those who've just played Ryder Cup and that have just won. They get lots of pats on the backs and people coming up to them on the driving range saying, well done. So, that'll be cool. I think there's a few of the younger Irish boys that are playing as well. And just quickly, what stuff that we will discuss over the next couple of weeks, we probably won't get into it now. Lexi Thompson is playing in PGA Tour event next week, which will be pretty interesting. And then just quickly, this TGL league between the Tiger and Rory are setting up. They've just inked a deal with ESPN to show it, which is just significant because Liv obviously couldn't get a good deal with TV. They got that CW network, whereas ESPN seems to be the creme de la creme. So that's going to kick off, I think, on the 9th of January is the date I saw. So that'll be interesting. I don't think anyone really knows what it's actually going to look like, but I'm looking forward to seeing how it plays.
Yeah, Larry just signed up to it.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, four lads were announced there. Tom Kim, Lowry. I think Jordan Spieth still isn't in it. He's one of the, or maybe he is now, but like, yeah.
I think Spieth isn't in it, which is a funny one.
It's one of the noticeable exceptions, yeah. But yeah, four more lads got announced alongside the ESPN deal. So it'd be cool to see Lowry involved.
That is cool. Right. we are around the hour mark, so we should wrap it up, boys. Thank you, gents, and thank you everyone for listening. We will chat next week after the Dunhill and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, cool. Cheers.